Hi everyone, and welcome to Fine Vines and Wine. I'm your host, Karis Pixie, and each week I'll be giving you all an insight into the behind the scenes of our favourite beverage, wine. I'd love for you to use this podcast platform as a winery guide for your next weekend away, exploring everything Australia has to offer. You never know, you might discover a new spot or two to visit. I acknowledge the Cadigal and the Wurundjeri peoples, traditional custodians of the land that we recorded today's podcast episode on. I pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging, for they hold the memories, the traditions, the culture and hopes of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples across the nation. So on this episode of Fine Vines and Wine, I'm joined by freelance journalist Cassandra Charlick, who writes for a broad list of publications, including Gourmet Traveller Wine, Delicious Magazine and escape.com.au. Thank you for joining me today. How's the beginning of your week been?
It's been good. I feel like my weeks and weekends kind of all blur around. So there's really no beginning and end. I feel like I live in a wine region, and travel is life as well. So It's every day is an adventure, really.
That sounds amazing.
Well, some days I am just sitting at the desk writing all day. That's actually the reality of a lot of what I do. But it's always around enjoyable topics.
So, I mean, food and wine is so interesting and enjoyable. So
it is, and it's, you never ever stop learning. You know, it never gets boring.
That actually leads us into our first question perfectly. How long have you been writing about food and wine, and how did you get into the industry?
I feel like some people take quite linear directions in their career. I definitely haven't been one of those people. I studied communication studies at university, but I also studied musical theatre. So my career's kind of jumped around. I've often had like parallel lives essentially running. So I started out doing a bit more arts writing. So I helped write a fine art column when I graduated, and then I've done theatre reviews and written plays and all sorts of things. Over my career, but I guess I've kind of always looked at what I'm doing to facilitate travel. And I've always had a very heavy focus on food. I've always enjoyed wine, but I guess it wasn't until I moved to Margaret River that I started learning properly about wine and really consolidating my knowledge. I wish I knew the things I knew now when I was traveling and had access to some of the wines and the experiences living in Europe. That's life, c'est la vie. So yeah, it was really since moving to Margaret River that I heavily focused on travel and wine and food. And I mean, that was quite a natural progression anyway, because I live in a tourism and wine region with an amazing food culture. So that's kind of how it happened. And I guess like a lot of things, it's a mindset thing. And once you make that switch and you know what direction you're going in, that's what you see, and that's where you go. So yeah, I've been very busy since moving here, which was about just over 5 years ago, I think now.
Perfect. No, I can imagine to be so busy. I haven't been to the Margaret River, but it's on my list and I would love to visit. It sounds amazing.
Yes, it is. You know, I think I live here and I still don't have enough time to do all the amazing things here. It's such a diverse region, really. There's so much. Anyway, I think we'll probably talk more about that further on in the conversation, so I won't go too far into it. But yes, you must get here. You must come visit.
I'm so like skeptical at the moment, or hesitant, I guess is a better word, of booking trips that cross borders, because stuff changes so quickly that you could have a whole trip booked and then they're like, oh, we're closing the borders, and you're like, oh, okay then, I guess I won't. So
yeah, it's hard I think for consumers, and it's incredibly hard for the industry. Yeah, but it's also understandable when there's that uncertainty, but hopefully it's not for too much longer.
So before COVID, were you traveling around Australia and writing and that sort of thing? And has that changed, or were you more just staying in the Margaret River and writing about that area?
Yeah, so I mean, I it's been, there have been so many silver linings to COVID, as difficult as it being, as it has been. I actually haven't traveled around Australia as much as I would like to have, especially in regards to wine. I really need to do a wine tour of Australia when I can. So I was very much writing about the region that I live in, but more so if I was looking at elsewhere, it was overseas. So yeah. I've done, you know, quite a bit on Europe. I was so lucky enough to have gone to Azerbaijan just towards the end. I think it was the year before COVID hit. I'm trying to, my timeline's so out of whack after having essentially, you know, the year that was 2020. And, you know, and that was phenomenal. So in terms of Australia, my life hasn't changed in terms of the Australia-wide travel hugely.
I like that you said about the silver lining with COVID, because I actually feel like everyone always focuses on the negatives, but I feel like for me, especially COVID really taught me to not be so busy all the time, or kind of to pull back a little bit. But because before COVID, I was going to like 3 events a day and I wasn't saying no, and I was like so busy and so stressed, and having COVID kind of helped me to, yeah, slow down a little bit. So I guess, yeah, there are some silver linings to it as well. It's definitely taught us a few things.
Definitely. Yes, absolutely. It was funny. I mean, I kind of felt like the initial period of COVID hit and I totally slowed down. All my work stopped straight away. Mm-hmm. And then I got crazy busy because suddenly everything was focused on, you know, where I live. Like it was statewide travel, Western Australia. We've been so lucky here with,
yes, you have.
I think with both of the approach of our, you know, our leaders statewide, but there's also a degree of luck. You know, we've just been very lucky as well, which has meant that, you know, as a freelance travel writer in Western Australia, I've been busy because people have been able to travel here other than our little, you know, 2 weeks of lockdown that we recently had. Yeah, I've been so busy.
What's your most memorable moment that you've experienced thanks to being involved in the wine world?
I'd have to say it's not one moment, but I think it's the generosity of the people in the world of wine. You know, I've just been blown away by the generosity of people with time, you know, their knowledge, sharing the actual physical product that is wine. You know, even this vintage, it's such a hectic and high pressure time for winemakers, you know, when you're picking the grapes and you're making the wine. And I've been hovering about and lurking in wineries, this vintage in particular, mm-hmm. and I'm just so grateful that, you know, I haven't hopefully pissed anyone off too much and they've just let me, you know, be a part of that, you know, and wine educators and winery owners. There was one moment, which was a few years ago when I just moved here, and I was driving back late one night and one of my friends said, come and catch up for a glass of wine. And I didn't realize that I was accidentally gate crashing the Christmas party for Howard Park and Martin and Birch, and I turned up and I was like, oh, I thought I was just having a quiet glass of wine to catch up. And I hadn't met Jeff Birch at that point, and I remember meeting him and chatting, and I said something about my age. And he just said, wait a minute. And he went down to his cellar and he brought back a bottle of, well, now everyone knows my age, 1985. It was a Grand Cru, 1985, from Bordeaux. And he just, you know, covered in dust. And he gave it to me, just said, you know, this is for you to open with good people that appreciate it. It's just such a pleasure to have met you, you know, happy Christmas. God. And, you know, and I was just blown away. It was a conversation we had, and it was, the people are so generous with everything in the world of wine. I think that's why I love it so much. It's, you know, it's, we're all brought together by something magic.
Yeah, and something that's so interesting, and I feel like people that love wine, they're really like interested in learning and interested in sharing that knowledge as well, which I love too. So I can definitely see that. And that would have been, have you drank the 1985 bottle yet?
Yes, opened it with friends, including the friend that I had gone just for a glass of wine with there. And it was, you know, it was so appreciated. You know, I think I do have discussions quite often with people that have amazing sellers, you know, or you know, anyone, and just say, when do you open a precious bottle?
Yeah.
And, you know, is there a place to open it with people that might not appreciate wine quite so much? And I think it's a balance. When you do have something that is that rare, or, you know, I do think there's a time and place for opening it. You know, I was chatting with Duke from Duke's Winery, and I said, when do you open? He's got that amazing cellar. And when do you open? He said, I think it's either on Wednesday or Thursday night, and he'll sit down and he'll open a bottle and he'll just appreciate half the bottle. And if, you know, by himself, if it's an amazing bottle and the right people aren't there to appreciate it with.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Like, I feel, yeah, there's some bottles that I have in my wine fridge that I'm always like, that my boyfriend's always like, oh, we should take this bottle and it'll be great. And I'm like, but no one drinks red wine, so why would we take that? Like, it's a heavy red, no one's going to enjoy it. So I kind of like that, yeah, like thinking about who would appreciate it and opening it with them, because then it's more special as well.
Yeah, it is. That's it. I'm thinking back now, like, maybe it wasn't a Grand Cru. I think it was a Premier Cru. I've got the bottle sitting on my bench, the one that I put. But either way, it's, you know, it's something I would never be able to access, at least, you know, at my point. Yeah.
No, I love that you kept the bottle as well. I keep all of my special memory bottles. There's quite a few sitting on my bar cart at the moment, but they have, like, such special memories to me that I'm like, oh, I just want to keep them and remember when I look at them.
Totally, much to my husband's. yeah, he's not as enthusiastic about my bottle hoarding. he's like, why do we have all these bottles lying around cluttering things up?
Like, definitely. No, my boyfriend's the same. He's like, can we just throw them out? I'm like, no, we can't throw them out. Like, oh my gosh, it'd be horrible.
Yeah.
So I completely understand it. It's fine. I'm just going to go off topic again. As you're talking, I'm coming up with different questions. So you said that you have been helping out during vintage?
A little bit. I don't know how much help I actually am, but I helped a friend with a bit of picking the other day, and I have done lurking. So I have done just hovering around. And watching things and asking questions, which I don't think that's classified as helping, but hopefully in one sense it's helping, because at some point I will share that with readers and people that are curious.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's helping in that sense, if not, you know, productively in the winery. Yeah, I mean, I would love the luxury. It sounds ridiculous, because I know it's not a luxury to many people, but I would love the luxury of, you know, of being able to take whole vintages going and working. Maybe one day I would do that, but yeah, my deadlines and all my my work, unfortunately, doesn't facilitate that at this point in time.
Which winery are you helping
at? Oh, hovering at. Well, I did actually pick. So I did some wine qualifications and study last year, and my dear friend who was the wine educator and a good friend, and she makes a very small batch of her own wine. So I actually went out last week and helped her pick Chardonnay in the morning, which was magic. So I really enjoy that. I think it's really a wonderful part of the process to be doing. You know, I think obviously if you were doing that for weeks on end, you'd probably have a different opinion by the end of vintage if you were just picking. But yeah, so her label, I don't know how far it's distributed. It's very small batch. It's called Cha Cha, and okay. It's very lovely Chardonnay. She might be making a red this year as well. But yeah, keep an eye out if you do see it. It's definitely, you can definitely get it in Western Australia at some places, but you can always just ask for it at if you're over east and see if they can get it in.
You're a journalist and you've been freelance writing. What's your favorite article that you've written? That's probably a really hard question, so give me your top three if you need to.
Yeah, it's a really hard question. On a very basic level, it's normally it's the one that I've just hit submit on, And yeah. I'm like, yes, that's done. It's a very nice feeling to do that. But sort of, you know, on a deeper level, it's normally the ones that I have a really personal connection to. Although, actually, that said, sometimes there are ones that I've been surprised by in the finished product. I'm just really proud of the story that I've told and found. I do love writing in first person if I can. I love sharing my personal experience. But a lot of the writing I do is not. It's a bit more removed. I did, in terms of travel, I mean, some of the stuff that I wrote on Azerbaijan was amazing. I've just finished, actually, yesterday, hit submit on a piece for Holiday, and I'm really happy with how the piece came together. It was quite a large topic to fit into one article and one in the word count. And I went up to Wollin Station last year, which is in the Midwest of Western Australia, and that was amazing because they're doing land regeneration there and doing things that no one else does. And I grew up going up to Station Country as a child, so there was really a real personal connection and history there. So, yeah, it's really hard. I love – there are so many stories that I'm proud of and love, and my pitch list is always massive. I have so many story ideas for every one story that I actually do.
It's so cool that you wrote for Halliday as well then. Is that for the most recent magazine that's coming out, or is that for their online?
No, it will be for the magazine. It will be for the next one coming out. Yeah, I've just done my first piece for them. So very excited because thank you. I love reading it, and been wonderful to work on the piece. So hopefully you enjoy reading it when it comes out.
Yes, same. I read it as well, so I'm like, I'll definitely look out for it. Can you tell us what the topic was, or do you have to keep that a secret?
I will just let you read it when it comes out.
So another question that I'm going to add in quickly. So with a lot of magazines closing recently or moving to online, or the magazine just completely being taken away, has that affected you as a freelance journalist at all?
I mean, I think globally it's been hard in journalism with print. The scene has changed. It was changing before I got into it. You know, you look at the life you could make as a journalist, you know, 10, 20 years ago compared to now. It's just a different, there are different models. You know, there are still definitely lots of opportunities, but, you know, it is challenging, but life just changes. The way that people get their information changes, and people never stop needing stories or wanting stories, and learning and seeking information. So it's, you know, there are always challenges, and it's always going to have moments of being tough.
I think
you'll find, you know, a lot of journalists do also diversify. So, you know, there's a lot of copywriting that people also do that you don't see their name on. And, you know, writing for different places and maybe slightly different topics, or writing for the topic they're interested in. But, yeah, as I said, copywriting, not having their name on it. And, I mean, I do photography as well as the written word, and I've been getting more into that, which I love, because I love visuals. I love visual storytelling just as much as the written word. So to be able to do both brings me personally a lot of satisfaction.
You know, I love your photos on your Instagram, because you've just been getting into drone photography.
I did. I've just started. I'm so glad. I did a workshop to start with some great guys called the Propeller Project, and I would not have had the confidence to have done what I did unless I had done that to start with. So my poor little drone is sitting in its bag at the moment because I've been riding so much over the last week, but I'm hoping to take it out again soon. Yeah, so I love it. I just love the combination of the two, and I'm actually, eventually I'll get to a point and have a bit of time, but I'm setting up my own sideline website to tell stories very much specifically in the wine travel arena, and put together itineraries and things that I can just tell on my own terms, which is fun.
That sounds amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's, you know, it takes a while to get it going, but you know, it's getting there. If anyone does want to sign up to the newsletter in advance, it's earnyourvino.com.
Perfect. I'll pop that in the Instagram description as well, so that people have it and they can access it. Yeah, I actually wish, when you said you did a mini drone course, I have a drone and I am terrified of flying it. Like, I feel like I just let my boyfriend fly it. And even when he flies it, I'm like terrified that he's going to crash it, that he's going to. And someone was like, but if he crashes it, like, as a drone, it's meant to be used. And I'm like, but it's also so expensive. Like, I don't want it to crash and break. Like, so yeah, I feel like I need to do a little, like, a little course in it first before I get confident.
It made such a difference. And I know that you love Harry Potter. And so there's one thing, because there's lots of gravel and dust and stuff around the beach as we were droning at, one thing that I would never have had the confidence to do myself is learning to take off and to to land, but without putting on the ground. So taking off from your hand and then catching it instead of letting it land. And every time I caught it, I just felt like I was grabbing the golden snitch. But there's a safe way to do it. And I would highly recommend having someone show you before. Yeah, because those propellers go around quite fast and they're hard.
Definitely. No, I've seen people post like injuries from catching drones and I'm just like, oh, that looks painful. Very painful.
Yeah, you need to know what you're doing.
Oh my God, definitely. No, I might have to look into that. I feel like I need something. So you're from the Margaret River, which we've already touched on, and I'd love to visit. What's your favorite thing about the Margaret River? Or again, I guess that's quite hard. So what is your top three favorite things?
Yeah. So it's in terms of like the Tourism Association, we look at it as the Margaret River region. So the Margaret River itself is the river, Margaret River, but the Margaret River region, and it's, I can't even do three top things, but I just love the diversity down here. You know, I think there are so many different things to do, and I think no matter what you come down here for, whether it's because you have an interest in wine or you have an interest in beer or you want to go mountain biking or you want to go surfing or you want to go hiking or you want to eat amazing food at restaurants, you come and do that. But once you get here, you discover there's more. And so I guess my biggest piece of advice to people that come down would be, you know, get off the beaten track. Don't just come down and just do one thing or just do, you know, do the things that you do every time. Do something different. And to be honest, I mean, I live here, but I always get blown away when I take a tour for my writing or even just personal interest. Like I go on a tour with someone that I know does a good job and you just learn so much. I think that's one of the biggest things that, number one, will help your knowledge and open your eyes to somewhere that you think you might already know. But number two, it also helps those tourism operators that are really struggling who would normally be relying on international tourism at this time of year. I just love seeing people who don't know what's on their back doorstep and they go and do that and just go, oh, my gosh, there's so much there I had no idea about. So, yeah. I could talk for hours on the place I live.
It's definitely on the list. So as well, this is probably another really hard question. What are your top three winery recommendations for the Margaret River region and why should we visit them?
Oh, so three definitely isn't enough. But I the way I like to travel and is the way I would definitely be writing about on my other website that I'm setting up, the Earn Your Vino, is I love slow travel and I love doing less and engaging deeper. And so in terms of like spending a day down here, I know sometimes you don't have a lot of time, you do have to fit more in, but I would say instead of three specific wineries, maybe look at three different types of winery that you can visit. So it's definitely worth visiting one of like the founders of the region, so one of the older wineries. So you know, Vass Felix, Cullens, Lewin. If you go onto margaretriver.com, you can find a lot of information and itineraries there. I write a little bit for them as well. So Sorry, I'd say, you know, definitely you have to. It's part of the history down here. And then make a point. I mean, we're so lucky here. There are still little small cellar doors that are family run. You know, there are quite a lot of wine regions where you can't go into a cellar door and be served by the winemaker or the owner. And so, you know, definitely make a point of adding one of those to your list. And there's quite a few of them. You can find them again looking, but like there are some of my favorites. I mean, I love Victory Point, and they have, you know, great wines as well. Ashbrook Estate, Windows, Cape Grace. You'll be served by the owners. And then I would also say try a food and wine experience as the third. Yeah. So not necessarily just going somewhere for lunch, but really seeing how wine interacts with food. And there are some really great experiences down here. I went to Voyager in January and did their cider tasting and then paired with lunch. And that was amazing. Passel Estate do a food and wine experience using handcrafted chocolate bonbons by an amazing chocolatier who's based down in Margaret River. And she does amazing things. Nadia Haskell, she's Harlequin Desserts, and the farmer's market is just amazing, full stop. You can go there and spend the morning and get incredible stuff. She's there. There are so many. There's lots of cheese, some really great cheese and wine pairing experiences. Yelling Up Cheese, great, and you can go up there and there's the wines from Grün Tycoons and those wineries with the actual cheese. There's so much, but I would say, you know, instead of specific wineries, try and do those three different experiences. That would be my recommendation.
I really like that. That's actually a great way to look at it, so then I guess you get to see like different areas of the region and still experience all the wineries. I mean, the food and wine pairing, that sounds amazing. That's right up my alley. I'm like, that would be great. I actually really like that way of, I've never looked at it like that, but I actually really like that way of looking at it. So,
yeah, I mean, especially if you have a limited time. I mean, you know, if you had forever, you just go to them all. Even I can't get to them all. By the time, I think there's 110 or something around that mark, cellar doors in the region. So, you know, you will never, by the time you get to them all, you'll be on to the next vintage and have to do them all again. So, be selective, but, be varied.
Okay, no, I really like that. What wines are the Margaret, what styles even is the Margaret River region known for?
Pretty much anywhere you go, the icons, it will be Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon, because we just have a perfect climate. We have a maritime influence. It's just a perfect climate to grow those grapes. But you know, we're also well known for we make some beautiful Sauvignon Blanc, classic Bordeaux blend of SBS or SSB, and there are some interesting alternative varieties cropping up as well. If you're interested in that kind of thing. But on the global level, we're known for our Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon.
Because I remember when you sent me a message on Instagram originally, and we were talking about Chardonnay, and I was saying how I really did not like it. I actually think I've changed my mind. I went to Orange a couple of weeks ago, and now I love it. And now I'm like ready to open bottles of Chardonnay. And so my mind's been changed on it, so I'll definitely have to try some Chardonnays from the Margaret River region.
Oh, wonderful, because they're, you know, and they're, we make beautiful Chardonnay, like it's just really, really beautiful Chardonnay. But there is, Chardonnay's changed from what it was in the 80s and 90s, where it was getting very oaked and the fruit was getting very ripe and it was just very big. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard of the ABC, anything but Chardonnay, and you know, and it's different, and I just love seeing people get surprised when they come down here because they taste it and they go, this isn't what I was expecting. It's much leaner, there's so much purity of fruit, there's less oak, and when there is oak, it's really nicely integrated. This is in the best examples, and there are so many examples down here that are, you know, that are amazing. Yeah, I could go on about Chardonnay all day long.
No, I was pleasantly surprised. I think, when I've ever had Chardonnays in the past, it's always been super oaked, and to me, that super oak Chardonnay reminds me of, like, the smell of wet dog, and it just, like, really, like, just do not like it, but the ones I was having in orange, they were just beautiful. So I'm glad that I've been turned, because I'm enjoying them a lot right now.
Good. I am very glad as well.
No, it's a very good. What wines are you drinking right now, apart from your Chardonnays, obviously? Oh. Or are there any Chardonnays you would recommend for someone who's sort of just getting into them?
Oh, I always love Chardonnay. I would say, in terms of, you know, if someone's just getting into Chardonnay, I doubt you're going to, number one, spend, you know, high, close to $100 on an amazing bottle. There is an amazing, you know, if you can, I mean, that's one of the great things about coming down to the actual wine region is tasting, is that you can go and taste, you know, the Lewin Estate Art Series and, you know, the amazing, the Heytesbury's and the, you know, the amazing top tier at Cullen's and, you know, these in Piero, and you can taste them without having to go and buy your own bottle. You know, you just pay a tasting fee and most of them are redeemable on purchase of any bottle. But there are lots of like entry level Chardonnays that are beautiful. You know, I think if you want to go and spend around the 35 to 40 price point, you can get something that's complex and lovely. There are way too many for me to go straight into.
What wines are you drinking right now apart from Chardonnay?
Yes, so apart from Chardonnay, I'm very wine curious. For me, one of the things that got me through COVID was traveling through my wine glass. So, you know, international wines, I do love trying all sorts of new things. In terms of right now, I've kind of made it my quest to fall in love, like it much more, Sauvignon Blanc. Because I think Sauvignon Blanc is at the risk of sort of being what Chardonnay, you know, falling out of fashion. The New Zealand Sauv Blancs, they were so popular and oversaturated, you know, and people are now leaning away from them, which is a shame because it still is a beautiful grape variety. And there are some really lovely examples down in Margaret River where you've got like a Fumé Blanc style Sauvignon Blanc, which is it's got a little bit of oak. And so, you know, it's very different to, you know, to a fruity Marlborough Sauv Blanc. You've got texture and complexity, and they're actually great food wines. So, yeah, so I've been making it my quest to fall back on Sauvignon Blanc and lighter reds, which is a massive trend, full stop, really, in the wine world. People are leaning towards lighter reds, which are great for a transitional season too, you know, like we're in autumn now. So yeah, I love a good Gamay, and I mean obviously Pinot. Reds. I love, you know, Etna. I've been having some lovely Nerello Mascalese, and yeah, I just love all wine.
Same. I mean, I do get what you mean about Sauvignon Blanc. When I went to Orange, I did actually end up buying one bottle, which from Swinging Bridge, which I was very surprised about. It. I feel like that one to me tasted more like a Riesling. I feel like as well, why a lot of people are very weird about Sauvignon Blanc is when you're first starting to drink wine and you go to the pub or you go to the bar and you're like, oh, I'll just get the house white. It's always a super cheap, super tropical Sauvignon Blanc. It's always house white. And I feel like that kind of has given it a bad connotation as well, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, it's part of the problem. So it's definitely not the first thing I would go towards, which is why I've been trying to drink a bit more of it, especially when I go tasting. I will always make a point of trying, to be honest, not like the more simple Sauv Blanc, but a lightly oak style or something that's been treated a little bit differently. And on that note, I love a good straight Sémillon. I think, you know, it's such an underrated grape variety, and I think, you know, like an aged Hunter Sémillon, you can get a really good value for amazing quality of wine.
No, my friend and I, we actually had a bottle of a 2016 Sémillon from the Hunter, and it was an organic as well, because she only drinks organic wine. So I was like, right, going through my wine fridge, I was like, I've got one bottle of organic wine, this will have to do. And we were both quite hesitant because this was before I was drinking a lot of whites, and she was like, oh, I don't really drink that many whites. And we actually both loved it. We were meant to have like two glasses and we had the whole bottle. So although now neither of us can find the bottle anywhere, and I'm like, oh gosh. But always the worst case when you drink something. I think it was a gift as well, and then you drink it and you're like, okay, where do I get another one? And I literally can't find it anywhere. So yes.
Well, as long as you, that's why mindful drinking and appreciating the moment is what it's all about.
Yeah, definitely. And we both definitely enjoyed it, so that's all that matters.
Yeah, totally.
Are there any wines that you're not drinking right now or avoiding?
Not really. It's just comes down to what I feel like. You know, I think, I guess the only time I would really avoid a wine is just if I don't feel like, and often those are, you know, the extremes. So like, it's a really hot day. It's going to be quite hard for me to have a super heavy Cabernet Sauvignon because I'm already hot, you know, or, you know, and food pairing as well. You know, you're not going to have something with a really high alcohol content if you're having spicy food, because you just explode. Mm. So yeah, there's nothing, I mean, you know, I don't like drinking bad wine.
Yeah.
That way, I, you know, that's, you know, that's pretty simple to say.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. We talked about it quite a lot on the interview I just did before, but what are your thoughts on natural wine?
It's such an ambiguous term.
I know it is. That's what we kind of spoke about that as well, that it's so broad, but
yeah, I mean, I think it's a very convoluted topic. I love good wine, and I don't really, to be honest, I love good wine, and I don't really care how it's been made if it's good wine in the sense of being attached to that sort of thing. Obviously, for environmental reasons, I would like a good wine to be made thinking about, you know, minimal impact, you know, helping the environment rather than pumping in chemicals and things. But on a basic level of the wine, I don't really care how it's made if it's good. But you know, and so I've had there are some amazing wines down here that are, you know, minimal intervention, organic, biodynamic. There are some that kind of halfway house. I've had awful wines that call themselves natural, where it's just like, you know, so volatile. I mean, that's the thing, like a lot of people that call their wine natural, like, it can be volatile, especially if you're looking at pet gnats.
Definitely.
You know, it's, and to be honest, I love kombucha, and I love extremely vinegary kombucha, so you know, I can actually sometimes drink a pet gnat that's gone a bit of a weird way, and if it's the right day and the right temperature, it actually hits the spot. But other times I would probably not want to drink that. So yeah, it's such a big topic. But I think the most important thing to take away is, like, there's no simple definition for what is a natural wine. Mm. And so people that might get their wine wanker on and, you know, and only drink natural wines or going to a natural wine bar, I do think that's rubbish.
No, I definitely agree with that. So seeing as natural wine is rising, what else do you think the wine industry will see more of or less of in 2021?
I mean, I think in terms of a trend, I think, as I touched on before, like those lighter reds, you know, people are definitely wanting something a little bit lighter, you know. But that said, there's always going to be a place for amazing wines made in, you know, whatever style. Like, it's the beautiful Cabernet Sauvignons from Margaret River are amazing. They're so powerful, they're so deep, and they're tannic, you know, and they need time to, they can be, some of them, you know, they can be beautiful drunk and young, but they really come into their own with age. So, I mean, I think trend-wise, I think lighter, I think alternative varieties, so we're just going to keep seeing more of, because people are interested. They do have a very strong environmental point. If you're looking at something that doesn't require irrigation, it's naturally suited to a warmer climate. And obviously climate change is a big topic that all wineries are looking at, you know, in the long run. It's like, are we still going to be able to grow in these dates, especially cool climates, you know, where Riesling and Pinot, they need that cool climate, and it's like, what happens if things warm up a bit? So I think alternative varieties, obviously, you know, there'll still be natural winemaking. I love seeing the shift to more organic and biodynamic. Yeah, and I think experimentation and I've been chatting with a few winemakers recently, and, you know, one of the beautiful things of Australia is we're not bound by tradition. You know, we're not Burgundy or Bordeaux. We don't have set, you know, prerequisites for blends or anything like that. And it means that you can make approachable, affordable wine in any way you like, in any blend you like, which is fun and exciting for consumers.
No, definitely. Because, yeah, in France, it's so regulated and so strict that I feel like, yeah, it's nice to sort of not have less rules, but just have that freedom to experiment a little bit more. Do you think there's anything we'll see less of apart from sort of heavier style wines?
I don't know whether we'll even see less of heavier style wines. I think it's just they might not be at the forefront of as much in terms of, you know, but less of, I mean, I think as would be lovely, you know, more quality, less crap is always ideal, but you know, you need both, you know, you need the mass production that is a place. I think it'll be interesting as well, obviously, with the difference in export with China and the changes there in terms of what's not being shipped off anymore, you know, what's staying in the country, the challenges that, you know, the way that wineries are going to work around some of the challenges in the industry. It will be, you know, it's interesting. It's always interesting.
Do you have any personal wine goals or even writing goals for 2021?
I just want to keep learning more. I feel like there's never enough hours in the day to do everything. I did a few Wessex qualifications last year, and so I'm kind of toying with where my next step is now, because I do love that formal. I love self-learning and just absorption, but it is really nice to have a bit more of a formal structure at some point and to be amongst like-minded people and at a similar point in their educational journey. I think really, you know, it really helps. So I don't know, maybe I'll look at diploma, but no, maybe something else. I just want to keep learning and doing more. I have a few passion project ideas that I will let you know about if I get them going. But one of the things that I've been blown away with this year, traveling so much in the Great Southern as well and around Margaret River and where I live is the stories, and realizing that there are stories that haven't been told, and I feel like there's a real time limit on them, because there are generations that are going to be leaving us very soon, and they were the founders. Like, they were the founders, they were the groundbreakers, they were the risk takers that got us on the map, that got things going. And so I would love to share their stories before it's too late, without sounding too pessimistic in that sense. But, you know, I feel like some stories have been told in some way, but I think there's still a lot missing. And in terms of a bit more of a legacy rather than just an article, or, you know, not that an article is just an article, but it's a little bit less, you know, something, you have a book or you have something that's slightly more tangible for a longer period of time than, you know, an issue in a magazine that, you know. Actually, that said, I was somewhere yesterday and I was flicking through like a book depository, and I saw a copy of I was like, I recognize that copy, and it was a copy of Australian Geographic from 1995. Back when I was subscribing as a child to it, and it was, you know, it looks like it had been printed yesterday. It was still shiny and glossy and sitting there. And, you know, I think you never know what captures the heart of a reader or a consumer of storytelling, and how it will touch them, and how, you know, it might be held on to for a very long time in whatever medium it is. You know, I think you can never undervalue what you're doing in any area of life.
No, I really like that. No, I think that's lovely. And I also love as well that how you're talking about always wanting to learn. Like, since doing this, I'm doing my Wessex level 2 at the moment training, but I just, I want to learn so much and just learn everything I can about wine. But it's such a broad topic and broad industry. There is so much to learn.
There's so much. And I feel like for everything that stays in my brain, like 5 other things go out the other ear hole. So I need to relearn them again. And I also hold my hand up. I definitely don't have like I don't feel like I have the most amazing palate. So I feel like I need, and sensory memory, and I feel like I need to taste a lot more to get something stuck in there than, you know, I'm very envious of people that can taste something and it's just with them forever. Same with back in my acting days when I had to learn scripts, I had to work and work and work to remember lines where, you know, some people just read something. I think Meryl Streep reads something, not that I'm comparing myself to Meryl Streep, but I think she reads a script like once or twice and it just goes in, like it's just... Yeah. There.
I would love that. Amazing. No, it's definitely fun. But yeah, I know what you mean. Like, there's just so much to learn that I'll like retain some information. And I'm the same as you. I don't think I have an overly sensitive palate either. So I do have to taste like quite a few times. And but no, I'm loving learning all about it. It's been great. So much fun.
It gets very addictive. And I definitely I think it can get frustrating when someone that you're with just wants to drink a glass of wine. You're like, no, I have to sit down and taste it properly. I want to taste it and then I'll drink it. But I do want to actually, you know, turn my brain on and sit here with it for a minute before drinking it.
No, I completely get that. But then there's the other side of the coin where if I'm out for dinner with friends, they're like, oh, you're studying wine. You pick the bottle. And I'm like, quite strange. What do you all like? Like, I'm like, it's just because I'm studying wine doesn't mean that I can pick the bottle every time, guys.
Yeah, but you can definitely help guide.
Going back to how you were talking about food and wine experiences in the Margaret River region, what's your favorite food and wine pairing?
I love food and wine pairing. You know, I think traditional pairings always work. And if you're not sure what to pair with, I always look back to see where the wine is from, and if it's an Australian wine, look back to where maybe it's traditionally been known for being from and what food they have there. So so if you're looking at really crisp white from France, whatever area, go and see what type of cheese is produced in that area if you want to know how to pair it really nicely. You know, is the area known for goat's cheese? Or, you know, oysters or beef bourguignon or whatever it is. In terms of, I love being surprised. Like, I love being surprised by a food and wine pairing. I love the challenge of pairing with spicy food. And so I do love, you know, finding the ideal aromatic variety with maybe a little bit of residual sugar to cut through that spice, like a Gewürztraminer Stramina or a, you know, slightly aged Riesling or something like that. I love the challenge of food and wine pairing. And sometimes I also just like not caring about it and going, I feel like this wine and this is what's for dinner.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I kind of feel like sometimes, like I would love to be all over food and wine pairing, but most of the time it's what I feel like and, oh, we're having this for dinner, but I feel like this, so I'm just going to have this and see how it goes.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it's all about enjoyment.
Moving on to our last question. This is something that I ask everyone and I find it's, even I'm finding it helpful because I'm wanting to run out and buy the bottles that everyone's suggesting. But if you could take any Australian wine to the below events, what would they be and why? So to a barbecue, a dinner party, and just when you feel like a couple of glasses at home after a long day.
So I'll probably just mention what I've had recently, which is the easiest. And I do also have a disclaimer that I got married last year, and so we do have some leftover wine from the wedding. So that's very often very often what we turn to. That said, it was very carefully selected wine.
Yeah.
So a barbecue, something easy to drink, you know, not too precious, but normally something that will go with red meat, especially if you're going to a barbecue at someone's house and you don't, you know, you might be taking a salad, but you're not really in control of what meat's going on. So something approachable. I mean, actually, I was out at the winery with Clive Otto, the winemaker, Fraser Gallup, a little bit hovering about, and I bought a few bottles. And that like entry-level, I can't remember the name of the entry-level red, their Cabernet Merlot is beautiful. I would say that's really, you know, it's a really good price point. And he makes his wine so interestingly. He has very different methods for the different Cabernet Sauvignons. And you know, that one, if you like Pinot, it's very pretty. Like it's almost, you know, it's a Cabernet Sauvignon for Pinot drinkers. Mm. It's definitely worth trying. And then if it's something white or a rosé, just something still with a little bit of texture. So I do love La Cookie, Glenn Goodall, who's the winemaker at Xanadu. He and his wife, Ellie, they have a cute range of quirky wines, but very well-made wines, you know, like it's not experimental in the sense that you don't know what you're going to get. Yeah. And, they're rosé blonde.
Okay.
It's really, really lovely.
Perfect. For a dinner party?
And then dinner party, we have lots of wine-loving friends down here and food-loving friends. So we do generally have nice wine for dinner party. I do have a nice bottle of Suave that I bought, Pierre Pan Suave, which is sitting probably waiting for the next one. And we've been going through quite a lot of red from the Great Southern region, because we just keep going back to Prongrots and Stirling Ranges to go hiking and have all the lovely wine from down there. So we've been going through Franklin Estate, have some beautiful wine, but they also have interesting varietals, very small batch, and that's organic if you're looking for organic wine. I was very upset because my husband opened a bottle of Touriga Nationale without me. 2 nights ago, and I was like, what? They've sold out of that. We only have 3 left. But yeah, they have some lovely alternative varieties. And Duke's, I think I mentioned Duke before. They just have some, his reds are just amazing. They're so good and they're good value as well. I could just keep talking. And Italian reds, I'm loving reds from Etna at the moment. Dinner parties are fun to try different wines, and as long as everyone's kind of on the same page with what they like drinking and quality and experimentation, it's always a fun wine tasting experience as well.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like if everyone that's at that dinner party is into trying new wines and likes learning about wine, then you can sort of bring different bottles, which I really like.
Yeah. I think so. Yep. And then I'm trying to think what the last one was. A couple of glasses of wine at home. Yeah. A long day, which is different. If it's not a long day and I actually just want to taste some wine properly, having a Coravin can help massively, because you can just open, you know, a couple of different bottles and then just gas it up and savor it. If it's literally just a long day, I'll generally open something I have access to replace easily. So something at a good price point that I'm not going to cry over if I don't finish the bottle with my husband and it needs to go into cooking. That doesn't happen very often. So, I don't know whether I even could be really specific there. I would say, something maybe like to a wine region that's close to wherever you are, you know.
Yeah.
I quite like drinking local, and that's great because I live in a wine region. like a Margaret River, anything. My husband did used to work at Lewin Estate, so my life is a little bit sadder since not having a glass of Art Series most nights, which definitely my budget doesn't allow to that. You know, like, it is nice when you do have access to a cellar door at the end of the day.
Wine
needs to go somewhere. You know, I think living in Margaret River, a lot of people can drink very good wine just because there are a lot of cellar doors.
And they're on their doorstep.
Yeah.
No, amazing. Thank you so much for coming on and joining me today. I've learned so much, and I definitely, definitely need to get to the Margaret River after this conversation.
Thank you
so much. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I have. Sorry if I've spoken too much.
That's great.
I get very excited about wine.
that's great. And I was saying before, my first guest was a woman, and then it's been quite male dominated. So it's nice to get some more women on and some different opinions. And
And in regards to my work as a writer and communicator, that is something I feel passionately about very much, is increasing the female voices in the industry. I think diversity is the best possible, you know, the more diversity we have, the better the world is. And in regards to wine, the better the industry is and the world of wine is. We all have.
No,
have
I definitely agree.
The table.
I definitely think there needs to be more women voices in wine. But no, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been great.
Likewise, very enjoyable.
Thank you so much for listening. Please rate, review, subscribe, and share with your friends. I'll see you next week for another closer look into the wine industry. Now go and grab that glass of wine. You deserve it.